Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Today, we begin with when and how war began, and then how wars and violent conflicts might be resolved. When did war begin? Some have argued that it evolved in early human behavior within foraging band societies. But our next guests say that's not true. Most forager bands did not wage war. With us is Douglas Fry. He is a professor and the administrator of the Peace, Mediation, and Conflict Research Program at Abu Academy University. He's also a research scientist at the University of Arizona and the author of Beyond War, The Human Potential for Peace, War, Peace, and Human Nature, The Convergence of Evolutionary and Cultural Views, and The Human Potential for Peace. Robert Kelly also joins us. He is professor and director of the Frison Institute at the University of Wyoming. He's the author of The Life Ways of Hunter-Gatherers, The Foraging Spectrum, Archaeology, and Archaeology Down to Earth. Welcome to you both, Bob Kelly, Doug Fry. Thank you for being with us here in the Scholar Circle. Maybe with this discussion about war versus cooperation, violence versus nonviolence, and where it began in humanity, we should start with a definition. Doug Fry, you started with a pretty clear definition to distinguish between interpersonal violence and war. Why don't you start us there?
For me, what's useful is to think about how we basically conceptualize war nowadays, because that's going to be in our minds as we try to look back and consider other situations. And I think there's pretty high agreement that war is something that occurs between groups, usually between groups of different communities. And right away, we start getting into a question, then what is a community exactly? But I mean, there can be internal group versus group fighting and external, you know, between different groups of different languages or culture histories or cultural backgrounds and so forth. But for me, the critical element is that it's group on group, it's between communities, and that it needs to be lethal. You know, every instance does not have to result in a killing, but the intention is to kill members of the other side, members of the other group. Like I say, I mean, I'm sort of coming at this from the point of view that we want to keep something, a definition that makes sense to us in our culture, and then look and see if this is existing in other contexts.
Now, how can you tell when we look back archaeologically at the prehistoric cultures and groups whether the violence was intergroup or within group or individually based?
Well, that's going to be a good question for Bob, too. I'll just start out by saying that sometimes you can't. It's ambiguous, but much of the time you can. And what has happened, I'll come at this sort of from a different angle, what has happened sometimes is you find one individual that shows sign of violence, and somebody who's writing about this person or reading a report lists that as an example of warfare. And I think that really goes beyond any credible determination there. It could be a hunting accident if it's one individual, or it could be a homicide. It's not necessarily war at all. It could be war in some circumstances or a raid. But what we do see in many situations is very clear evidence of warfare. If you have defensive villages or settlements where there's palisades or archaeological evidence that the site has been defended, just also the location of particular sites where they're up on the top of mesas or up against cliff faces and so forth, this starts showing defensive or indicating warfare. And then, of course, you have the skeletal remains where you would find not just the one incident of lethal violence, but you would find whole skeletal populations that show a lot of violence and, you know, multiple skeletons with projectile points in their bones are found within their body cavities and so forth. You also can find specialized weapons that are not used in the normal peaceful daily life of farming or even of hunting. And all of these things would start to indicate warfare. Again, depending on the cultural context, the marker is going to be somewhat different. But one of my arguments is we're thinking about the origin of war, and I'm suggesting that it's relatively recent as opposed to going way back over the millennia, is that if you look at the archaeological record going back, you don't find examples or, you know, solid evidence of warfare beyond about 10,000 years ago, with one possible exception. And that's one bit, but you also find patterns of seeing no archaeological indicators of warfare and then a shift or a change in different regions where you can actually see, oh, in this region, such as Valley of Oaxaca in Mexico, war is developing, and here's when it developed, and here's a village being sacked, and now here's fortifications, and move to a defensive location, in this case being the top of Monte Alban, or the top of the hills near what is now Oaxaca City, which is this grand archaeological site of the ancient Zapotecs called Monte Alban. What I'm saying is it's not just a question of the evidence is sparse and you're looking back and maybe it's war, maybe it's not in the distant past, but you're also seeing that there's no war, and then there's cases where war develops. There's other cases where it goes along and doesn't develop for a long time. But I'm really curious to listen to Bob on this point as well, because he is the archaeologist, and I just pretend to be at times.
Bob Kelly, would you agree?
Yeah, the evidence for organized warfare is relatively late in human history. When I say late, I mean from the perspective of an archaeologist, that humans have been on their evolutionary sequence for about 6 million years, and war really doesn't show up until sometime in the last 10,000 years, and mostly in the last 5,000 years. So it's a relatively late occurrence. That said, there's certainly evidence for human violence in many different places in the archaeological record and extending quite far back in time. We don't really know if all that evidence for violence is really a sign of people fighting. Broken noses, which are fairly common archaeologically, can occur from lots of different things. I'm probably not the only person who's broken his nose playing a friendly game of basketball. Individual fighting has been around for quite a long time. And I suppose the critical question that some people have raised is that if you come up with a restricted definition of warfare, then sure, warfare appears fairly late in human history. But perhaps these earlier evidences of violence are simply an earlier manifestation of a human proclivity for violence that shows up as just one-on-one fighting rather than group versus group fighting. That's been what some people have said, that revenge killings, feuds, if we don't define those as warfare, then we've certainly biased our ability to see warfare as being something very, very late.
There were a couple of things in your paper, Bob Kelly, that I thought were really interesting. One was that you said warfare was more common among non-egalitarian hunter-gatherers than the egalitarian foragers. What do you think the egalitarianism has to do with it?
It's probably not so much egalitarianism, although that feeds into it, but non-egalitarian hunter-gatherers from ethnographic data, those tend to be sedentary hunter-gatherers. They're not nomadic. They're living in larger villages, and they've located themselves at some prime real estate, and that they have to then control it. And I say they have to control it because sedentary hunter-gatherers live under high population densities. Most hunter-gatherers who are nomadic, they solve problems by moving. If there's not enough food in one area, they move. If they've got a disagreement with somebody, they move. This is how they deal with problems. They walk away. If you're a sedentary hunter-gatherer, you can't walk away from problems because there's somebody already living where you could possibly move to. Well, every environment goes through fluctuations, good years and bad years. A nomadic hunter-gatherer deals with bad years by moving someplace else, and they can do that when there's low population densities. Sedentary hunter-gatherers can't do that because there's somebody else there. So one option is to try and push them off.
So perhaps then what we're talking about is maybe the birth of a territorialism mixed with the issue of natural resources and having adequate food supply, water supply, and other resources that you need to survive. Would you say that's so?
That's when territoriality arises. Nomadic hunter-gatherers have some pretty intricate ways of relating people to land, and they do think that they don't own the land, but they own the right to be asked to use the land. And normally, the right to use land is given if you ask. But you do have to ask. So that they have territories, but they're not the popular vision of territories. They're not bounded entities that nobody can use except our people. They will let other people in if you ask. And the reason they want to be asked is so that they know who owes them favors in the future, so that they can then move on to someone else's land in a future time when the tables have been turned and their territory is not being as productive as they'd like.
Doug Fry, let's bring you back in. First of all, would you agree with this?
Yes, I do agree with this, sure. I mean, we can mention a couple of ethnographic examples from Australia or the Kalahari, where water holes in the Kalahari are owned by individual persons or groups of people. And if you ask, then permission is always granted to use the water in that water hole. Similar things go on in the Great Western Desert in Australia, where there are sort of porous, they've been described as open boundaries, so to speak. And it's important. I mean, first of all, there's not really enough personnel among these nomadic forager bands to try to defend and keep others out, so that's one problem. But it's also just sensible that maybe you have some resource that others need and you let them use it, but in the future it's understood that you'll have a shortage of food or water, and you'll need to use or like to use some nice windfall crop that they're having. You know, I say crop in quotation marks here because we're not really talking about agriculture at this point. These are the nomadic foragers. I thought this might be a good point also to mention the recent results from the science paper that came out over the summer, because this relates to some of these issues as well. And that is that I'd like to talk just a little bit about a group and what is a group. It relates to, obviously, this question of warfare and how old is warfare. It's a presumption, clearly, that a group is an existing entity. We were used to thinking of countries. We're used to thinking of communities or villages with identity like this and identification. And I think it really is hard for most of us 21st century Westerners and perhaps others around the planet to really get into the mindset of what it's like if you're in a nomadic foraging society. The bands, as a rule, are shifting in membership. And any individual, that they refer to it as an egocentric type of kinship organization or social organization, because any individual has friends and relatives in, you know, a band that's over off to the east and a band that's off to the west, various other connections with people across the landscape. So when these bands, as they are moving regularly, they camp for a while in one place, generally speaking, and then move on somewhere else, the composition shifts and changes. And as Bob pointed out, if there's a conflict, a band may just fission. And these are, again, small groups. So maybe it's a situation of a man, two wives, and a bunch of kids, and perhaps a brother that's a little bit younger. They head off, you know, they're separating from the rest of them after some sort of dispute or something. So the point is that these models of group versus group, and these would be some of the models that are coming out of primatology using chimpanzees, for instance. There's a group of chimpanzees that do a border patrol, as described in the literature, and if they manage to spot a lone chimpanzee off in a neighboring group and they outnumber them, say there's three against one, they may attack and even kill that chimpanzee. But this type of model, it seems to me, from reading the ethnographies about nomadic foragers, is not commonly, not typically the type of thing that's going on in the human societies across the landscape. So there may be a problem with the chimpanzee model of these more discrete groups that just simply don't apply to nomadic foragers. And like I say, it really, to me, it takes quite a mind exercise to start thinking of this. Now, when we say group, we're not really talking about a group. We're talking about a porous entity with people shifting and membership spread across a large area, actually. So, I mean, who's fighting whom, I guess, is another way to look at this. You wouldn't fight the neighboring group where your brother is. You wouldn't fight a different neighboring group where your father is. And this is going across language dialects and language groups in many cases as well. So it's not just something that's occurring within the same ethnic collection. Hunter-gatherers tend to move over large areas and interact to some degree. I recall one estimate, Joseph Birdsill, long ago from Australia, estimated that across the language divisions, there was 15% intermarriage for these nomadic foragers in Australia. So things are not as neat and clear, but I think the main point of this is if you're going to just propose a model, which has been done repeatedly, where you have one prehistoric group fighting the next historic group over, this is really out of touch with what the ethnography would suggest about nomadic bands if we can use that as a very rough analogy, as I think what it might have been like, or the way to put it this way, because I know, you know, Bob may be a little bit more cautious and rightly so about wanting me to say analogy or not. But in any case, it raises the question, I think, you know, are these groups really fighting entities? I think there's much more evidence that these are individual disputes. So if you have these individual homicides and individual cases of violence that you can find archaeologically or that you hear about it in the ethnography, they do tend to be, for the most part, individual disputes, not group versus group disputes.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about when and how war began. Well, let's break down a couple of the numbers that you had in that science article, since that's where we've gone so far. You mentioned in that article that, of course, most of the lethal events did not involve group versus group. But what I thought really was interesting was that three-quarters of the intergroup disputes were really among one of these particular bands.
Yes, right. The exception that proves the rule, so to speak. And I mean, the main finding, as you say, maybe we should just recap this briefly, because I'm sure listeners have not been out, or most listeners have not been out reading this type of technical report. The main idea was that a majority of the homicides involved one person killing another person. I just say lethal events, and any lethal events whatsoever, individuals, group, whatever, it involved one person versus one person. And then from there, we catch almost 80% of them if we include multiple persons killing one person with just one victim. So, I mean, this could, in one definition, be raiding with a group motivation, but we looked at the motivations. Why are these nomadic foragers engaged in this lethal aggression? And there's where we come back to the personal reasons for these types of things. So out of 21 societies, nomadic forager bands, this one society, the Tiwi of Australia, stood out as the exception to the rule. And the very interesting thing about the Tiwi, at least this is my interpretation of all of this, is that they actually had clans in comparison to almost all of the other societies we looked at. And when you get the clan structure, all of a sudden everything changes. So I was just talking about the groups. Clans are a form of group. They're a type of, obviously, social segmentation. And what we saw for the Tiwi was feuding certainly coming in as it would go back and forth from one killing to the next to the next. And we actually, for the whole sample, all 21 societies, there were 9 cases of what we would call a string killing or a feud back and forth, 9 particular events of these. 7 out of the 9 were in this one culture, the Tiwi, meaning there were just 2 elsewhere in other societies. So I think that really shows a lot. Human social organization is flexible, and human cultures are flexible. So it's not, we can't overgeneralize about these things.
I wonder then, if you have one particular group that is more violent, per se, more warlike, then does it automatically generate fear and insecurity in the other groups and make them feel a little bit more protective and perhaps warlike? Bob Kelly?
You're asking, does it have a domino effect?
Yeah.
And I think that's absolutely true. And it happens once people become sedentary and decide to put themselves down on one part of the landscape, and they've done that because they've stopped moving because there aren't places that they can move to. So now they're going to try and keep control over this one location. If that's a really good location, and obviously it's going to be one, you can think of this as a game of musical chairs, and people are going to sit down when the music stops, and it's the best chairs in this case that are going to get taken first. The people who have the lesser, occupy the lesser places on the landscape, they're the ones who are periodically going to be in trouble more often than those folks, the lucky folks who sat down on the good places on the landscape, which means the people who sit on the good places are going to be more likely to be attacked by those who find themselves in need of food more frequently.
So it kind of confirms a bit of what some international relations scholars talk about when they say that war is a result of insecurity. Yes. Particularly when you have a kind of an anarchic system. You don't have a global police that keeps people from attacking each other. And also there's a guy who studied intergroup, it was actually called Why Men Rebel, who said that it's perceived deprivation that leads people to then rebel and attack another group. So it sounds like what you're saying is when we look into ancient history, it sort of confirms those theories.
I think it does. It's important to realize that a lot of the arguments are based not so much on archaeology, but they're based on the ethnographic data that we have on hunter-gatherers. And this was the utility of Doug's article in Science, where he went through all of that those data very, very carefully to show us exactly what it is that's being discussed in those ethnographies. And as he said, it's a lot of one-on-one violence and not warfare. The other utility of ethnographic data is that the hunting and gathering peoples live in lots of different circumstances. Some are sedentary, some are nomadic. Some live in very productive environments. Some live in rather marginal environments. When I've gone through those data and looked at measures of warfare and measures of homicide, I find that they tend to correlate with measures of population pressure, not just population density, but the number of people relative to some measure of the environmental productivity. And they relate in very expectable ways that people fight more, have higher rates of warfare or higher rates of homicide when population pressure goes up, when there's pressure on the food base. And in those cases, people are fighting, they're anxious, they're a little more tense because they may periodically not have enough food. Those under high population pressure live with the constant fear of not having enough food and wanting to put something in place to alleviate that fear. This is completely expectable. Hunter-gatherers are really behaving just like any other human being.
Doug Fry.
Yeah. Yes, I think it's important to contextualize this a little bit on the time frame of things. I certainly don't disagree with Bob's work. I've read it and appreciate it. But just to highlight, and when we're talking about these nomadic forager groups, they're really going back over the millennia. You know, this is the way that humans have lived through the Pleistocene in some form of hunting and gathering, as opposed to being this type of sedentary forager, which is sometimes called sedentary foragers, sometimes called hierarchical foragers, complex foragers. There's different names. But the key difference is that these groups have settled down, and this has occurred for the most part within the last 12 to 13,000 years. There's one case that I know of from Russia, where it's back quite a bit further. These settled groups, as Bob talked about earlier, are the ones that tend to be rather warlike. So I don't know, maybe he also would want to elaborate just a little bit on this. I know his studies when he's talking about homicide, that may apply across these groups. But what we really see as a dramatic difference between these two types of hunter-gatherers is when they're nomadic, the disputes tend to be interpersonal, homicides and such, for the most part, not exclusively, but for the most part, if we look ethnographically. And that corresponds with the paucity of what is clearly warfare going back over the archaeological record, the deep archaeological record. Whereas when we start getting warfare within foragers, this tends to be the settled groups, and they do tend to settle down in these rich areas. For instance, the northwest coast of North America is an area that recently and historically and prehistorically has had a huge number of these groups near salmon runs and rich marine resources, which basically allowed them to settle down, the population densities to go up. The most coveted places, such as the mouth of a river near a salmon run, to be fought over and so forth. So I just wanted to clarify this. I think it's important that we keep in mind there's different types of foragers, and they have a very different time frame. Some people have muddled this as they write about the issue, and it's important to keep this straight.
Well, Bob Kelly, before you respond to that, I want to add one more question, which is really your final question in your piece. Under what conditions does the benefit of cooperation outweigh the benefit of competition, particularly violent competition? Drawing from your own work and what Doug is saying, how do you answer that?
Violent competition always has an extraordinarily high cost to it. And that cost only goes up throughout human evolution. It goes up because one person invents a spear and another person invents a shield. So the other person invents bows and arrows, and the other person invents palisades, and then someone invents gunpowder and cannons. So we invent bigger walls, and it goes on and on and on, really until we reached nuclear weapons. And that there it kind of stops, because it's mutually assured destruction. That's the first time that the world reached that point. So, and that cost is partly in terms of human life, but it's also in terms of other resources. And we see it happening in the world today, people not opting to use their military because it's such an enormous cost. What did we spend in Iraq? $1 trillion? And people have reached a point where war is extraordinarily expensive. There's a huge cost, besides the obvious cost in human lives. That's the point at which people start saying there has to be some other way to work things out. That's the point at which cooperation is going to be the cheaper option than competition.
And Doug Fry, before we have you respond to all this, one thing that you were talking about in terms of how these groups related to each other, that oftentimes they had relatives in the other groups and brothers and sisters, or maybe it was just a distant cousin, made me stop to think about anonymity and how important that was in violent conflict between groups such as war. And it made me think of the Christmas truce when during World War I, after I believe it was the Germans and the British in these trenches got to know each other, they couldn't kill each other anymore. How do you think this?
Very interesting example. I mean, a couple of thoughts. I'd like to piggyback a bit on something that Bob was talking about, and come back to this whole idea of the fear, basically. And, part of the fear stemming from lack of resources, or fear that the resources are limited and so forth, not having enough, or just living in fear of being attacked by some other group, which is a major one. As I've been studying peace studies more recently and just thinking about these phenomena, I think it's a fair generalization, or a true generalization, that people everywhere would like to live a secure life. And by that we mean, free from fear of attack, certainly a big one, plus all of the other things that are just considered necessary and helpful for life, a roof over your head and adequate food and clean water and so on and so forth. And on the global studies or international sphere of this, there's a new term called human security. By contrast, the existing way that the United States has operated in the last 50, 60 years has been a military security, to the extent of basically ignoring other factors that are really important: a clean environment, protecting us from radiation, from nuclear plants, and from nuclear weapons. The fact that there could be a nuclear weapon, as Bob just said, and this would be mad in multiple meanings of the term mad. But what people really want, it's not that they want military might. They actually want to feel secure. So this then brings me, in my mind, back around to this idea of cooperation. The military model is not working, so we need to shift, I really think, and I think the hunter-gatherers show us this as well, over to a different conceptualization of what is security, that would involve a human security and a cooperative strategy to achieve that. So I think this is where we are on the globe. If toss out some big ideas here towards the end of this interview in that way as well.
Bob Kelly, last word.
I think what I've learned from hunter-gatherers is that there really is no one single human nature. You can't say that it's human nature to be violent, and you can't say it's human nature to be peaceful either. We have the capacity for both, and what hunter-gatherers teach us is which of those capacities comes out has a lot to do with the conditions that we live under and how we choose to organize our societies. It's entirely up to us. It's not human nature.
Bob Kelly, Doug Fry, thank you so very much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Douglas Fry is a professor and the administrator of the Peace, Mediation, and Conflict Research Program at Abu Academy University. He's also a research scientist at the University of Arizona and the author of War, Peace, and Human Nature, The Convergence of Evolutionary and Cultural Views, and The Human Potential for Peace. Robert Kelly is professor and director of the Frison Institute at the University of Wyoming. He's the author of The Life Ways of Hunter-Gatherers, The Foraging Spectrum, Archaeology, and Archaeology Down to Earth. When we come back, The Psychology of Resolving Violent Conflict. Stay tuned.
It's time for peace. Time for peace. It's time for peace. Oh, yeah. Time for peace. We'll stop the killing fields in the desert sand. We'll end the war machines all across the land. Let me tell you, it's time for peace. It's time for peace. It's time for peace. Oh, yeah. Time for peace.
Welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. We've been talking about how and why war began. Now we turn to resolving violent wars and conflicts. We're joined by three experts. Mari Fitstuff is with us. She is professor and director of the International Program and Coexistence and Conflict at Brandeis University. She's authored books including the award-winning Beyond Violence, Conflict Resolution Processes in Northern Ireland, and she's co-editor of a three-volume series, The Psychology of Resolving Global Conflict, From War to Peace. Douglas Knoll also joins us. He's a lawyer and a mediator who specializes in peacemaking. He's written books including Peacemaking, Practicing Human Law at the Intersection of Conflict. Douglas Fry also joins us again. He is a professor in the Developmental Psychology Program at Abo Akademi University in Finland and the author of books including Beyond War. Great to have you all. So what I'd like to do, I think, is to start with Mari Fitstuff. You co-edited this volume, starting with human nature and our assumptions about human nature and how those play into conflict or peace. Let's begin this with the very premise of what is natural to humanity.
It's very interesting, Maria, and I'm sure that my two colleagues on the other end of the line have this experience as well. But if you're at a party and somebody asks you what you do, and you say you're working in international conflict, you often find people roll their eyes up to heaven and say, you can never do anything about that. It's natural to human nature. And I think the reason for pulling these three volumes together was actually to see what the reality about that statement was. Is it so natural that we do give up the idea that we can change things? Or is it something about the context, something we can actually affect? And I think that we were really interested in hearing from the best in the field the actual truth about whether or not it's natural. I know some of my colleagues will be talking about it, but, you know, essentially, I think we're coming to the conclusion that there are some tendencies we do have to be aware of, that those tendencies within particular contexts can be used by leaders, and that there are very many things that we can actually change about our environment and our context that can make sure any tendencies we have towards aggression or violence can actually be balanced out with other possibilities.
There are a couple of the authors that are clearly not going to be able to be joining us, partly just out of the pragmatic feature of radio. But one of them you mentioned in our correspondence, Dr. Connor, and there was another one, Brian Ferguson, that I wanted you to briefly talk about their work.
I think that Mel Connor is above all a realist. He's written a marvelous book called The Tangled Wing, which is the biological constraints on human spirit. And frankly, I think every policymaker should read it. His thesis is that we are shaped by our past. In evolution, certain things have been facilitated, our development and probably our competitive development. And some of these things would be our ability for our group to safeguard our group against another group. And also particularly, I think, the tendency to differentiate another group. However, he's very clear that this tendency can be balanced by other possibilities within a society. And many of the other authors would say, yes, there is this tendency, but it is not inevitable that it works itself out. I think Brian Ferguson has an interesting perspective. He would agree with a lot of what Mel Connor says. But he says, essentially, he's focusing on the idea of identity, which is a very crucial aspect for many of our authors. The need to belong, the need to belong to a group, the need to see another group as the enemy, and to see our interest in seeing that as the enemy is what actually initiates much of our activities in terms of violence. So he would say a particular group sees it as in its interests to actually start a war against another group, that you don't, it's not a natural tendency, it's that they see something to be gained, whether it's in terms of territory or often in terms of their own survival. And I think, for instance, many authors would actually see this as, there's a marvelous author called Gerard Prunier who has written about the Rwandan War. And he says that one of the unspoken truths about Rwanda is that it's so very, very highly populated and there actually is not enough land to go around.
So resources are a big deal.
The resources are a big deal, and that in Rwanda, unconsciously, what was happening there was a fight for people, their particular group, to get enough land. And I think we can see that playing itself out. And the more we know about those kinds of tendencies, obviously, the more we can put in place to limit them, as it were.
Doug Fry, you have been writing and studying peaceful societies. Why don't you tell us about some of these societies?
Societies are very interesting for several reasons. And one is that their very existence shows that it is possible to create a social organization where people behave and resolve their conflicts nonviolently. Also, between different societies, some of these peaceful societies are also non-warring societies. So this also shows that humans don't make war everywhere and always, which of course pertains very centrally to your questions about human nature. So peaceful societies, I want to first of all point out that for the chapter for Mari's book, it's co-authored by Bruce Bonta. And Bruce Bonta, I call him sometimes Mr. Peaceful Society. He became interested in these societies some years ago and has a website that is very interesting, just filled with good information. So I want to plug the website and make sure that anybody's really interested in pursuing this. It's a great place to start. It's www.peacefulsocieties.org. But in terms of what peaceful societies really tell us in regards to human nature, if there was something in human nature that forced us or pushed us towards making war, then we really would expect to see this across cultures. So the fact that there are non-warring societies sort of begins to break this down. But the next issue is to look and see, are there some commonalities that we might find about the non-warring societies? And this is a ripe area for research. But one thing that's come out very clearly is that it does relate to complexity or simplicity of social organization. So there are different types of societies, but the type that goes back over 99-point-something% of our human and pre-human history would be a very simple type of band society, where the people live in small groups, 25 to 50 people perhaps, sometimes smaller, usually not larger, and they're nomadic. The women and the men do have different ways of focusing on making a living, so to speak. The women are gathering tubers and plants, nuts and so forth for the most part, although they may, if opportunity arises, you know, kill small animals. Whereas the men are hunting. What's very interesting about this type of social organization is it can provide us a model of human nature, roughly, if we look across these different societies and try to pull out generalities. And one thing I've done in my research is to do exactly this. And it comes out that most of these simple nomadic bands do not make war. So that's an intriguing finding as you're thinking about human nature.
Yeah, there are a couple of things. There are a couple of things that you, one thing that you mentioned and a couple that were in the chapter I wanted to actually have you contrast. One is that these sites that you just described are not industrial societies. And then there are two other things that you said in the book. One is that the violence is determined by their value system and worldview. And then the third thing, which I want you to bring in after, is the dismissing of peaceful societies in this industrial society. So why don't you address those, and then we'll move on into some of the other factors here.
Okay. I'll give it my best shot. You're asking three very interesting types of questions here. I want to point out, yes, of course, most of the peaceful societies are rather small scale, but there are even countries such as Norway, for instance, that has got a very peaceful orientation. Costa Rica, after World War II, basically gave up their army, and so they could be considered a non-warring society. Norway does participate in defensive maneuvers and so forth. They're not exactly non-warring, but they have a real emphasis on peace internationally and domestically. So there are large groups that also are very peaceful. What was the second topic that you wanted me to...
Oh, about, you have said in your chapter that they're determined by their values and worldview.
Yes, yes, very much so. And I think this has got a real relevant lesson as you know, you think about any society, including the United States, and how we view war. There are studies that have been done that link attitudes about human nature into activities for peace and engaging in activities for peace and demonstrations and such. And there is a negative correlation here in the sense that if you view that humans are naturally warlike or have instincts for aggression and this sort of thing, then you're less likely to actually engage in pro-peace activities. So unfortunately, what we can get here is a self-fulfilling type of prophecy where people view human nature as naturally aggressive, humanity as warlike, so it's not motivating them to think about alternatives or to take action for peace. So what we find in the peaceful societies, in the non-warring societies, they really have different beliefs. And this is something that the people reiterate in their daily conversations. For instance, this group of Xingu, Upper Xingu River Valley tribes that live in a non-warring system. And there's 10 tribes. This is in Brazil. And no war has been reported amongst these tribes for well over 100 years at this point. And the attitudes that come in is they look at aggression as something that is just showing a lack of control. And this is bad. People should be in control of their emotions and activities. They also think of someone who loses control as basically, they put him down, they criticize him, gossip about him, and so on. These are elements of values that help to reinforce an attitude that you shouldn't be aggressive or shouldn't be a warrior.
Well, let's bring in Doug Knoll now. Now, Doug Knoll, you actually look at the role of these neurochemicals, and you're saying, you know, most of human behavior is not even conscious, that these neurochemicals and subconscious urges are actually what's driving conflict.
It's more the neurochemistry. It's also the neurophysiology of the brain and the central nervous system. But I think that what we know, the knowledge base that it's expanding about the brain and social neuroscience is expanding extraordinarily rapidly from where we were in the mid-90s. And more neuroscientists are beginning to study topics such as emotionality, aggression, decision-making, the role of executive function, how impaired brains are involved in bad decision-making. And a lot of really interesting and salient information is coming out of this research that's directly applicable to understanding conflict, and most particularly for what I'm interested in is the direct application of process and practice in the actual art of peacemaking. So what we know is that we're 98% emotional and 2% rational, and almost every decision that a human engages in has an emotional overtone. Sometimes that emotionality is understated, but most of the time it is overstated. And in conflict, of course, certain areas of the brain are stimulated primarily in the amygdalic regions of the brain, which are two small little almond-shaped processes in the forebrain. And as Dr. Fitzduff said earlier, I think it was the Johnson article, noted that our upbringing is important here because it's upbringing that determines how the brain is actually physically developed.
Talk about that. How does that work?
Well, the human, from the time the human brain starts to form in gestation until about 18 months, there's actually a requirement that a child go through both natal and neonatal or postnatal, has to go through certain life experiences that the caregiver has to provide in order for the brain to form properly and to process properly. And if those opportunities are missed, the brain will never, ever, ever develop properly, and there is no way to correct it. I am under the belief right now that all crime is nothing more than, and violence for that matter, is primarily caused by dysfunctions in the brain caused by early childhood development. Now, that's a pretty broad statement, and you also have to recognize that this kind of behavior goes across a continuum, but there's some amazing research.
Quick question on that. Can they be corrected once...
No.
So once damaged,
that's the problem. You can do some behavioral correction, of course, and some of the problems can be modulated by drugs. But we have plenty of examples of severe dysfunction where people really cannot function normally, and that's the sad part. And that's why we really need to, if we want peace in this world, we have to be investing in the children, and we have to make sure that from the time a mother becomes pregnant until a child is at least 4 or 5 years old, that child is showered in love. I mean, that's the answer.
It sounds trite and weird,
but that is exactly what has to happen.
Mari Fitzduff, go ahead and come in.
One of the most fascinating things for me was I lived in an area in Northern Ireland that was actually called the Killing Fields, because the murders between the two sides were the second highest in any area in Northern Ireland. At the same time, there was never a theft in that community. There was never a rape. There was never a murder. The paramilitaries who were out at night often took care of the children, taught them music, etc. So somehow they had been taught that violence against the other group simplified the other, and a violence against the other group was okay. But the maintenance of their own community and the behavior within the community was actually almost impeccable, so much so that at the same time as Northern Ireland had a war going on, it had the lowest crime rate
That's
in Western Europe.
Fascinating.
So somehow these children had learned communal murders are okay. Individual, even striking, even beating, even not looking after old people was not okay. So this does, to a certain extent, I think, point us back to the context within which these people grew up, where
Absolutely.
They were given a value that valued intra-community building and caring, but did not value, obviously, extra outside external caring.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about how wars and violent conflicts might be resolved.
Actually, Doug Fry, if we could bring you in on this, too.
Yes, and I can speak very well on this from my own research as well, which I did a number of years ago in Oaxaca, Mexico, comparing two Zapotec communities, the ethnic group, that were side by side and in other ways extremely similar. But what I did was I very systematically observed children's behavior, 24 children in one community and 24 children in the other, did it on a random rotation, and just recorded how the children were interacting with each other and with the adults, what type of socialization was going on, and all types of behaviors. The other thing, then, is to compare the actual aggression in the two communities. Well, the place which I call La Paz lives up to its name, certainly. There's rather a small amount of adult aggression. It's rare to see men get into a fight, rare still to see women exchange. In fact, I don't believe I ever saw women get into a physical altercation in this community of La Paz. If you look at the homicide rate in La Paz and compare it with the other community, which I refer to as San Andreas, in San Andreas, there's a higher murder rate, about five times higher. You will see fist fights at a fairly common intervals. And in the course of my field work in these two communities, I saw three wife beatings going on in San Andreas, none in La Paz, and so on and so on. So the point is, you've got two very different communities in terms of the accepted amount of aggression and the actual observable amount of aggression. And these are forming in some way, so the theory goes, a learning environment for the children.
So they're
actually... This is, in fact, just to give you the heart of the children data, this is exactly what I found. The children in the 3 years to 8 years age range were already much more aggressive in San Andreas than they were in La Paz. Social learning, socialization, punishment of the children, these are things which the peaceful societies generally suggest are very important in developing children who are either aggressive or non-aggressive. And then certainly it dovetails with the specific example I've been talking about from Mexico as well.
So there are actually two distinct things we're talking about here. One is the actual socialization, and one is the actual biology, which is what you, Doug Noel, were talking about. You know, it's interesting that you say that you can't repair that.
What I'm saying is, when you get into extreme cases and you see extreme sociopathic behavior, typically what you're going to find is some kind of serious brain dysfunction. But, you know, the thing about human beings and the human brain is that it's extremely plastic. And that means that...
You mean malleable.
We can learn all kinds of behaviors, and every time we learn, our brain changes. So I'm really talking about the extreme cases where we have, you know, where we're not capable of repairing. But the point is that if we're really looking for peace, I think all of us would probably agree that social upbringing, how children are treated, you know, how their identities are formed, the social norms, all of that stuff is important, both from a social psychology perspective as well as from the development of the human brain. And my interest is primarily in what interventions can be utilized by a mediator or a peacemaker understanding this stuff.
Yes. Why don't you talk about that? Because, and link it to what you talk about the fear chemistry. And...
Well, we know in conflict that people have a fear reaction. And we also know that people have a belief structure that is embedded in the brain in certain interesting ways. And once we begin, as peacemakers and mediators, begin to understand this, and we watch conflict behaviors when people are engaged in aggressive behavior or showing high emotionality, that they're acting out in violent ways, that the interventions have to be based on what those people need. And I think, at least in the work that I do, what I have learned is that before you can get anybody to start negotiating over anything, you have to respond to their emotional needs. The parts of the brain that deal with rational thinking, the executive function of the brain, really shut down quickly when people are emotional. And so mediators and peacemakers, I think, sometimes put too high a premium on the rational-centric view of human beings and not enough emphasis on understanding that when people are emotional, they can't listen. And so the interventions that we use really have to be directed towards de-escalating people emotionally before we can start problem-solving.
Mari Fitzstuff, I heard you coming in.
Yeah. I think Doug is absolutely right. I think, and unfortunately, many of the programs dealing with these issues happen in universities where the irrational is assumed, and I think we pay far too little attention to the immediate emotional responses. But what I'm particularly interested in is what responses come out in a group situation, because I think we've been hearing a lot about individuals and their upbringing. But for instance, if you ask students, as I do, I will ask my students how many of them have been involved in a riot. It's amazing how many put up their hands. And when you ask them to think about how they behaved in a riot, they will very often, sometimes with a great deal of shame, say that they behaved in a way they did not believe it was possible for them to do. And I think a lot of the evidence we have is that much of what happens, another example I have is I sometimes ask my students, to their horror, to plan a genocide in a particular country. They look at me with horror, and they find within about 10, 15 minutes they can get down with gusto to that task, and they actually look up at me and say, it's so easy. Mm. And one of the things is because the whole question of how you manipulate groups, the whole question of what happens in situations of war where people who hardly knew they were Serbs or Croatian suddenly find themselves killing people they've been living beside for the rest of their lives. And a lot of that is a function of what happens within a group. And I do think that we need to pay a lot more attention to that, because there's a tendency within us, and some of the articles in particular look at this, the whole question of categorization. As human beings, we're lazy. We like to simplify. We like to simplify groups as good and other groups as bad. And I think that we like it when things fall into something that is easily understandable. We dislike it when we find there are good and bad within each particular group. We much prefer to know who our enemies are, we're the good and they're not. And I think we have to pay a lot of attention to the fact that the evidence is people behave very differently. This tendency exemplifies itself in groups, often in a different way than it will when there's just an individual concerned.
Mari Fitzstuff, I'd also like you to address the chapter about humiliation.
That was written by a woman called Evan Linder. And yes, I mean, one of the things that really is worrying is that people do not understand. If you read the stories of any of the paramilitaries in Sri Lanka, Palestinians, Northern Ireland, ETA, what you realize is that their choice does not seem to be rational. It is only rational if you understand it in terms of their needs and the need to be respected, the need to be understood, the need to prove meaning in your life, the need for a young man to prove that he can be a hero. All of these transcend rationality. And I think the chapter on humiliation is a very good one, because it shows that those kinds of feelings that actually can be addressed in us, particularly by, if you look at a situation, for instance, like Gaza, what happens to people who are at the end of a situation like that, who are the victims of a situation like that? It can be that they become completely enraged, completely caught up in trying to redress that kind of humiliation, and a war continues to go on, not just in Gaza, but in so many of our conflicts around the world.
Let me bring Doug Fry in. How do peaceful societies continue in keeping themselves peaceful, and how do they protect themselves?
Well, this brings in the idea of this peace system, which I think I mentioned just briefly at the beginning, that one thing that can keep societies peaceful is if the neighboring societies are all part of a union. We see examples of this anthropologically. For instance, on the Labrador Peninsula, the original hunting-gathering groups there, they existed in small bands, and they never made war on each other.
But we don't have that in society today
well,
that much.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I'm going to jump all the way to the European Union. And this, I would argue, is a peace system freshly created and still in the process of being augmented. You know, after World War II, French thinkers and other German thinkers and politicians came up with the idea of the central problem, really, how can we prevent another major war on the continent? And through a whole series of political steps over decades, literally, they created this brand new regional entity, this polity. And it's been, if anything else, totally successful in making the war threat basically go down to nil. So nobody expects, anticipates that there would be a war within the European community. And I mentioned the Xingu tribes also. That's another peace system. Occasionally they have had to defend themselves from the groups on the outside, and that is a problem. I mean, this is something that either you get run over, you get driven away, or you defend yourself. I think the European Union holds such an important lesson for the planet overall. I mean, granted, it's much more complex when you're talking about the entire globe and societies that are so very different compared to Europe that although it has diversity socially and culturally, there are some similarities in common histories and so forth. But we think back to what happened in World War II and where we are today.
Doug Knoll.
I think that what we conclude in this, what turned out to be a pretty amazing three-volume piece of work, is that people who are engaged in international peacemaking tend to be too much in their heads and not enough in their hearts, I think. And the advice, I would like to hear what my colleagues had to say about that, but I really do think that the work of the peacemaker is a work of the heart just as much as it is of the mind, and attending to the emotions, the identities, the respect issues, the justice issues that the people are experiencing when they feel like violence is the only way that they have to respond to their environment is something that's oftentimes overlooked. And there's a lesson to be learned here. I think it's something that more research and attention in terms of developing mediation and peacemaking processes must be attended to.
Mari Fitzstuff.
I think one of the things that horrifies me is there's a saying here, follow the money. We talk about a huge amount of money that's actually going in, $1,000 billion at least a year, going into how we can make war. Just listening to the three of us, we're all working in a system whereby very little money, very little time is actually put into how we make peace. And I think that that is the saddest thing of all, that in fact we don't take it seriously. I think many of us hope that with a new regime it will be taken more seriously, there will be more resources put into it, and save an awful lot of grief around the world.
Well, the three of you, Mari Fitzstuff, Doug Fry, Doug Knoll, I want to thank each of you for being with us. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Maria. Good to be with you.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to the Scholar Circle team who makes this show possible, Ankine Aghasyan and Melissa Chiprin. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed a part of the show, you can go back either to the kpfk.org audio archives, or you can go to scholarcircle.org. You can hear us on iTunes and on Stitcher, and you can follow me at Armudian.
It's time for peace. It's time for love. It's time for peace. Oh yeah, the olive branch and dove. Time for peace.